Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. The new Outlaw God with Stephen Paulson is living over there now. Two episodes into that podcast, and I've listened to both of them, enjoyed both of them. Stephen Paulson's one of those guys I could sort of just listen to riff for a while, and all of a sudden, 2 hours has gone by, and I didn't realize it. Not that the podcast is that long. It's only about 30 minutes, but it goes by quick when someone's just dropping interesting things on you. This is true about Paulson, Chad. He is one of those guys. I don't know if I've ever heard Stephen Paulson speak and not taken something away from it. And I don't mean the way that, you listen to like any, good preacher preach and you take the gospel away from it. I mean, take something away from it. You're like, huh?
Never thought about that before.
I haven't thought about that. I'm gonna have to mull that one over a little bit. Which, is fun. So now there's a podcast where every week Paulson's dropping something that I'm at least rolling around in my hand a little bit, looking at it from different ways. And so that's kind of a fun thing. So I recommend people give that podcast a shot if you're interested in experiencing that.
Yeah, he's one of those guys, like, you'll receive whatever he gives, and then the next thing you know, you're writing something, you're speaking somewhere else, and you're using it, right?
Yeah. I remember listening to him talk one time about election, and the only passage was Joseph being thrown in the the cistern. Joseph didn't feel very elect at that moment after having all these dreams. And I'm like, this guy's a genius. This is not like, who chooses this passage?
Right. There's a man who knows how to use the Old Testament.
There you go. That's man after your own heart, huh? Now?
Yes, exactly.
But if you hear it, if Chad hears him do that, Chad knows next time I speak about election, I'm at least going to have to bring up the fact that Joseph didn't feel very elect after all these dreams that God had given him when he's sitting in the bottom of a cistern.
Yeah. Well, I have a theory that I never say anything original, that somewhere along the way, somebody else said it. And maybe I heard him and I forgot. I'm just using it as my own now. Yeah. What's really frustrating is you'll write something or you'll, interpret some verse. You'll say something, you'll think, man, that is so original. I bet nobody's ever said that. And like the next week, you read it in a book. I don't know how many times that's happened to me. I think I come up with some original idea. Nobody's ever thought of this or said this before. And then blown out of the water by somebody else.
Yeah, dude, I've gone to like speak at conferences and stuff before. And I'll have some, because usually conferences are themed out and stuff. Mm-hmm. And someone that I'll have something that I think is great, and someone before me will make my point, and I'll have to, and I'm editing on the fly, like, well, can't say that now.
Whoops. Yeah. Let's put quotation marks around that now. Somebody else said it.
But check out Outlaw God. It's over there wherever you listen to podcasts. It's available there, so check that out. Chad, we're still in the first chapter, towards the end of the first chapter of the book of Ruth. We left with Ruth's words to Naomi about not leaving, about her God being her God, and that she's determined to stay with her.
Yeah, it was a good beginning to the book last time. Talked about some introductory stuff and kind of got the characters. We have more characters to come, of course, but we met everybody and we got the journey begun back to Bethlehem. So we'll see what happens now. So we'll pick up with verse 19, finish out these last four verses of the first chapter. So I'll just go ahead and read those to kind of get it in everybody's head. So they, it's talking about Naomi and Ruth, so they both went until they came to Bethlehem. And it came about when they had come to Bethlehem that all the city was stirred because of them. That Hebrew verb translated here as stirred could be like, everything was sort of a buzz, something like that. Anyway, it was the whole city was sitting up and taking notice because of them. They've been gone a long time, years and years. And so I'm figuring most people thought, never going to see Naomi again. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" And she said to them, "Do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi? Since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me. So Naomi returned, and with her Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, who returned from the land of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. So there's to begin with, there's some stuff here in the Hebrew that I think is worthy of notice. And you can see this even in most English translations, because the obvious wordplay that is used is going to be footnoted in most of your versions. So the 20th verse, when the people say, "Yeah, is this Naomi?" She replies, "Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara." And Mara is the word for bitter. And then she goes on basically to explain that, "For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me." Interestingly, I think this is the only. I don't think that she meant this like literally, like, "Don't call me Naomi anymore." You know, she's just making a point. But this is the only case in the Old Testament where someone basically changes their own name. You know, so yeah. We have a lot of name changes in the Old Testament. But this is the only case where someone says something similar to this, either in a positive or in a negative sense. So "don't call me Naomi," which means pleasant or beautiful or something like that, because my whole life has now changed. And as most people know from reading the Old Testament, names are not just kind of a word that you stick on someone. It is instead indicative of the whole person. So a name is identical to the person. Same with God. That's why you don't misuse the name of the Lord your God. It's not just a series of vocables, but it is a representation of God himself. We get this, I think I've made this point before, that we get this because when someone starts maybe spreading lies in using our name for it, not misusing our name, you know, "Chad said this and I never said it," or "Dan said this and you never said it." Well, we get angry, of course, because they're misusing our name.
Well, fortunately, that's never happened to me.
Yeah. Just speaking theoretically.
Yeah.
Never happened on social media or in any other context.
No,
I'm always quoted, and everything I say is always, you know, read with the putting the best construction.
Yeah, no one's ever attributed words to me that don't taste like mine. That's never.
Yeah, happened. I'm not sure what that would feel like. But anyway, everybody I'm sure has experienced that to some extent, and anyway, that's what Naomi is communicating here, that not just her name, but all of who she is has changed. Because now this is significant. She doesn't say, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, because I fell on hard times," or "because just experienced this whole string of bad luck," or "because literally I lost my husband and my two sons." She attributes everything to Shaddai. That's the Hebrew word that's used here, which is more of a title than a name. Usually El Shaddai, the Most High God, but sometimes it's just abbreviated as Shaddai, because Shaddai, the Almighty, has dealt very bitterly for me. So as is typical throughout the Old Testament, this is attributed directly to God and not to just whatever else. I mean, we do have instances in the Old Testament, and we'll see this when we get to Chronicles, where you kind of have a juxtaposition. Sometimes it's attributed to God, sometimes it's attributed to Satan. So what's kind of going on there? Well, we'll deal with that later on. But most of the time in the Old Testament, when people describe not just good things, but bad things, they attribute that directly to God. Now, what do we do most of the time? We say God allowed something to happen or permitted something to happen, but you won't find that kind of description in the Old Testament. There's no speaking of God let this happen or allow this to happen. Instead, they understand that in some way he was involved in this. And in this particular case, she actually goes right to the source and says, "God did this to me. He embittered my life." And she's not done. She says, "I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty." It's kind of hard to describe in just speaking about it, but I'll see if I can describe what's happening here with the Hebrew. So if we were to translate this more literally, it'd be something like, Let me find myself in the Hebrew here. Okay. I full went out, but empty I returned, or empty brought me back the Lord. The point I want to make is that the I and the Lord are at the beginning and the end of the sentence. So it's structured that way so as to kind of give the impression, just rhetorically speaking, as if there's the greatest separation between Naomi and the Lord. So the very way that it's written is odd in Hebrew. You don't write Hebrew in this way, which makes me think it was quite purposeful that she places herself at the beginning of the sentence and the Lord at the end of the sentence so as to indicate that there's this chasm, there's this break that exists between them. But what she's doing is basically once more attributing everything to his actions. I went out full. The Lord brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi? Because two things going on here. The Lord, Yahweh, has witnessed against me. The Hebrew that's used there, the verb is ana, which usually just means to answer, but when it's joined to that preposition, it means it kind of takes a legal connotation. Like if there's a court and you have witnesses, and one of the witnesses is speaking against someone, is testifying against them, that is the particular language it's used here. So the Lord is represented as if he is on the witness stand, somehow testifying against Naomi. And not only that, she goes on to say that the Almighty has afflicted me. Now, not just afflicted me, but keep in mind who she is. She's a widow. And if anyone is supposed to be taken care of in the Old Testament, and if anyone is supposed to look over these people, the widows, the orphans, it's God. So what Naomi is doing is setting herself up here as one who has been attacked by God, afflicted by God, embittered by God, testified against by God. This is her form of lament, which we talked about last time. This is her as doing what the Psalms very frequently do. Except the only thing that I wish she would have done differently, this is just me, I wish she would have actually addressed this in prayer to God, which is usually what a lament is. You know, rather than talking about God, you talk to God. So when you are feeling attacked, embittered, testified against, abandoned by God, well, then what the Old Testament would have you do is to translate all of that into the words of lament in which you actually speak directly to God. You don't talk about him to others, but you talk directly to him. So if I were Naomi's pastor and I was sitting there kind of listening to her go through this, I would say, you know what we need to do? We need to pray some Psalms together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you can, you know, cuss it out with God a little bit.
Yeah, you got to do.
I mean, it's interesting. You can understand maybe why somebody would think, "Don't call me pleasant." The Lord has testified against me. He has taken the stand against me.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not someone I probably want to go speak with. He seems to be interested in my takedown, right?
Yeah.
Then you know, in the ESV, you have the Almighty has brought calamity upon me.
Yeah.
So she's attributed it entirely. He brought this calamity on me. So this is his doing, right? Which it would maybe be another reason why you'd be like, probably not going to go to that person with my concern. So this is sort of the understanding she's operating with is, is literally that the Lord is against her, right? I mean, because if somebody's going to testify against you, like they're not on your side,
right? Yeah. Yeah, this is there's a book I read years ago. It was on the Lament Psalms. I can't remember the author's name, but I've always remembered the title, When God Becomes Your Enemy.
Mm.
Or When God Becomes My, I think it's When God Becomes Your Enemy, not My Enemy. But anyway, it was capturing the essence of these Psalms that are like this, where, and many of the Psalms are, I mean, they use this same kind of language, where God has either abandoned or is actually actively attacking Israel. So it's one of the strange things about the Psalms is they actually give us words like that. Like God gives us words to say to him when we're angry at him.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, from a human perspective, is really strange. It'd be like, you know, me telling my wife, you know, next time you're angry at me, here's what you can say.
Yeah. And it's not, I'm sorry.
No, it's not. No, it's not at all. I was reading, I don't know if I can find it when we're was sitting here, but I was reading, here it is. I was reading a commentary this morning where a guy was talking about these verses, and he was just taking Naomi to task. I mean, he did not like at all what she had said. So he describes her as dealing with God as if he has sovereignty without grace, power without compassion, judicial will without mercy. He describes Naomi's viewed side by side. There's no doubt that the young foreign woman cuts a more impressively noble figure than Naomi does. And then this is really what got me. In the end, the reader is repulsed by Naomi, but drawn to her Moabite daughter-in-law.
I don't know, man. I don't know, man.
I'm not.
I'm sympathetic.
I am too. I love Naomi. I love her honesty.
Well, dude, this is what you have to know. So it sounds like God is sovereign, but not gracious. Yeah. Well, we don't exactly have a Christ yet. This is in the time of the judges. I mean, go back to what we just read. Obviously there's moments of grace and stuff in the judges, and God delivers them and this kind of thing, but yeah, it's an easy thing to backfill it and be like, yeah, but what about Jesus what about God becoming flesh and taking on the sins of the world and dying for you and giving you his free gift of salvation? This isn't exactly in the hermeneutic that Naomi's working with yeah. here, right? Like, all she right. knows, there's a certain amount of hubris attached to the claim you could go off into a country, have your spouse die and all your kids die, come back and just be like totally convinced of the grace of God with no knowledge of Christ.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, man. Like, if that's what you think, if you think that that's how you'd respond in that situation, then you're a better man than me, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it's so easy to sit in judgment on like he did with his comments there. But yeah, at the same time,
they just expect everybody to sit there like Job and be like, blessed be the name of the Lord, right?
Yeah, well, I was just about to bring up Job, you know, and people often, you know, they refer to that particular incident. I'm like, keep reading.
Yeah.
You know? Read the next chapter. Once you get past the opening prose section to the rest of the book, the first thing out of Job's mouth is, cursed be the day of my birth.
Yeah.
There's no more, oh, thank you, Lord. You've given and you've taken away. All praise be to you. No, he's like damning his birthday. He's like, I wish I'd have died in the womb. And of course, he goes on throughout the rest of the book to use the same language as Naomi. Like, you know, he can't get a day in court yet. Like, he wants to face his accuser. He wants to talk to God face to face, but he can't.
Yeah, there's no. If you think that Job is just sort of this guy that has this great understanding that he's a sinner and that God is just, you're not reading it right, because what Job definitely understands the sovereignty of God. He understands that, like, God isn't somehow lost control, and this is why this stuff is happening to him. He knows that, but he's also like, I want to go to court, and I want to go to court now, because this is unjust, because I am a pretty righteous dude.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the theme that reverberates through all those chapters. And then you get to the end, and God says, Job has spoken of me rightly, and his friends have not. So I think of that when I come across comments like I was reading earlier, where someone is repulsed when a character speaks of God this way. Well, you're going to be repulsed by a whole lot of the Old Testament. Whole lot of the Psalms.
And I just think I think Naomi's acting human. Like, again, I mean, I don't know how you think you'd act in this situation, but if you remove the full knowledge, I mean, obviously, not saying that Naomi doesn't have any promises or anything like that. Obviously the gospel is present in the Old Testament. It's in shadows. That window is a little dirty. You know, it's not, you don't have, you know, she doesn't have what we have where you're mm-hmm. like, this all looks horrible, but I know that Christ is coming again, and the resurrection of the dead, and the new heavens and the new... You don't have all this, man. So, like, if you subtract a sort of clear picture of all of those things, and just sort of say, I know that God is good, but this is what's going on. I mean, if you think you would do so much better, I don't know. I don't know if I'm buying it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, it's one thing to know God is gracious and merciful from the Old Testament, but it's quite another thing to look at the crucified Christ and to truly see grace and mercy there.
Yeah.
That changes everything.
Especially in the time of the judges, when you're like, well, let's see, how does God operate? You do the bad thing long enough, and he, like, knocks your head off. This is sort of how this has been going, and Naomi feels like her head has been knocked clean off her shoulders at this point. So she's obviously, and this is why I think she even uses this testify language. She's like, obviously we did something that he really didn't like, because we are being, I mean, this all seems like she believes that she's being punished for something. And I know we don't know what it is. And I think that the best thing we've got is kind of what we said last week, is that she might think that God is not exactly happy that they ever left in the first place and went and hung out with the pagans and intermarried. And she is the only thing that I can at least pull from the text to be like, you have to at least wonder, is she thinking this journey was a really bad idea?
Yeah.
And now she's coming back to Bethlehem with this Moabite daughter-in-law.
Right. Yeah. She's bringing a foreigner back with her. And we kind of fit. I mean, if you read through the curses of the covenant that are talked about in Deuteronomy, Leviticus, a lot of what is talked about there, or a lot of what happened in Naomi, fits with those covenantal curses. So, I mean, we do this all the time, right? We kind of slip into this kind of view of tit for tat. You know, if I do this wrong and then something bad happens to me, I'm like, oh, yeah. You know, the two might not be in any way related. But yeah, I know I messed up doing this, and then all of a sudden something bad happens. I'm like, yeah, this God coming out to get me, right?
Mm-hmm.
We do these kind of things in our minds all the time. So it makes sense that she'd be thinking the same thing.
Yep.
Okay, well, it's chapter one, chapter two. So we're going to meet somebody new now at the opening of the chapter, and we're going to have the first interaction between him, that is Boaz, and Ruth. So we're going to spend quite a bit of this chapter out in the field. Let's see what happens. Now, Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth, the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, "Please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I may find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Now Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, "May the Lord be with you." And they said to him, "May the Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servant in charge of the reapers answered and said, "She is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab. And she said, 'Please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves.' Thus she came and has remained from morning until now." And there's a few words after this, and nobody really knows what they mean. My New American Standard has, "She has been sitting in the house for a little while," which makes no sense. They're out in the field. And the English Standard Version has, "So she's continued here from early morning until now, except for a short rest." So there's four words in Hebrew, Zesh, Yiftah, Habayit, Ma'at. And nobody really knows how to translate those. It's just kind of a mystery. So literally, it'd be this, her sitting, the house a little, which makes just as much sense in Hebrew as it does in English. So whatever that means, we'll kind of leave that to the side for now. All right, so we got the scene set up, and we meet Boaz. This is kind of a literary device where we're introduced to someone in the opening verse, and then he kind of fades away for a few verses and he comes back in the scene. So we're told that Naomi had this relative of her husband, a man of, well, could translate it different ways. So he's a man maybe of great wealth. He's described as someone who is Gibor Chayil. Gibor can be someone who's a warrior, someone who is maybe a powerful person in the community. So sometimes translated as a man of great worth or a man of great standing or a man of substance, whatever it is, it basically is indicating that he's not just your typical guy. So he has some clout. He's a member of the community that has some influence, maybe some wealth, has servants under him. So he's not just your typical guy in the street. And his name is Boaz. Then Ruth says to Naomi, this is probably March or April, so the spring of the year, it's when the harvest is beginning, that she's going to go out and she's going to glean among the ears of grain. And we probably all know what gleaning is. It's when someone who doesn't have their own property, doesn't have their own fields, is basically living upon the mercy and compassion of others. When they go out and glean, they're just going out and basically scavenging. So they're able to maybe pick up heads of grain that have fallen down, that the reapers dropped. It was part of Israelite law that the corners of the field were not supposed to be reaped. Instead, that portion was to be left for people such as Ruth, so that she could go out there and gather enough grain, basically just to exist on a hand-to-mouth lifestyle. So I've compared it in the past to, it's kind of like someone in our society living off of basically picking up trash or maybe recycling aluminum cans. So what do? You know, that was just what they do. When I was driving a truck, I'd see these guys all the time who would pull up in this old pickup truck next to a dumpster, and they would go through the dumpster and, you know, maybe they'd be getting out some rolls of carpet that they could go sell somewhere, or maybe they're collecting pallets that they go sell somewhere. But that's kind of this existence. You're just basically living off of things that other people have thrown away or left out for you to pick up so that you'll have a little bit of something to live off of. So she's gleaning, and there's a great expression here. Literally, what my translation says, she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz. In Hebrew, it is that her chance chanced upon that portion of the field. And it's like we might even translate it as luck would have it, something like that. But it's a big old wink. You know, like it's one of those exaggerated winks that somebody might give you. You know, like not subtle, but it's like when they want to make sure that you see it, and like big old wink, like, yeah, did you catch that? So her chance, she just, you know, happened out of sheer luck to come to this portion of the field that belonged to Boaz. I think this is a significant verse in the whole book, actually, because this is the author's way of making sure, just in the way that he phrases it, that we don't miss the fact that the irony is that it wasn't chance, is what the author's trying to do.
Yeah, this is
all set up.
This is like if you have a crush on some girl, you find out that she's going bowling on Thursday night, and then you just so happen to be going bowling on Thursday night, and then, you know, and as she arrives, you're like, what are the chances? You like bowling too?
Yeah, that's exactly what's going on here. Yeah, except the one who's setting this all up, of course, is God and his providence. He's directing all of this. It just, you know, she happened to be there, and it's not even done yet, because verse 4 begins, "Now behold." Now, I think we're so used to seeing this word in English translation that we sometimes forget its significance. This is, anytime you have behold, it's wanting to get your attention. It's like, hey, watch this. Hey, pay attention. Or hey, notice this. That's the purpose of a behold. So now behold, hine. Boaz came from Bethlehem about the same time. So not only does she end up in his field, Boaz is showing up at exactly the same time. And he says to the reapers, this must have been some sort of customary greeting. I mean, we still have this in church today. A lot of churches will say, you know, the pastor will say, may the Lord be with you, and they'll respond, and also with you, or and with your spirit. So he says, may the Lord be with you, and they respond, may the Lord bless you. So kind of a ancient religious greeting, I suppose, something like that. Then Boaz said to his servants, you know, who is this? Whose young woman is this? Like, to whom does she belong in the sense of, like, what family is she from? Or, you know, is she connected with a man or a woman in some way? Is she a servant of someone? Because, of course, he recognized that she's not one of his own. And the guy who's in charge informs him that this is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the land of Moab, and she requested that she be able to glean among the workers who were out in the field. So, picking up from there, verse 8, we'll see what happens. Boaz has a few things to say now. So he goes over to her, Boaz says to Ruth, and says, listen carefully, my daughter. Do not glean in another field, and furthermore, do not go from this one, but stay here with my maids. Stay here with my female servants. The verb for stay here is davak. It's the same word that we saw in chapter 1 where it says that Ruth was cleaving to Naomi. And I pointed out in the last episode that this is the same verb that's used in Genesis chapter 2 for a man to leave his father and mother and davak to his wife, cleave to his wife. So stick close, we might say. Don't move. Stay here with my maids. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded my servants not to touch you. So this is like, you know, Boaz's sexual harassment policy, I suppose. Leave her alone, you know, don't mess with her. And he's commanded them this. And then he says, he just keeps adding more and more that he's going to do for her. You know, if you're thirsty, he says, go to the water jars and drink from what the servants have drawn. So he's going overboard. I mean, he's wanting to make sure that she's taken care of. Don't go anywhere else. Stay here and stay by the female servants. And I've given some instructions to the guys to leave you alone. Don't mess with you. And what's her response? She falls on her face and bows to the ground. This is the verb that's used in Hebrew for worship as well. We've talked about this many times in the past, that when you worship in Hebrew style, your whole body is involved. You don't just sit there and worship in your heart. Your body is included in the worship, because literally it means to worship in Hebrew means to bow down. It's very similar to the Greek. The Greek translates this Hebrew verb into proskuneo, which literally means to take a knee. So to worship is to bow down or to kneel down. So she's bowing to the ground. I don't mean by all that she's worshiping him. It just, this was what you did when you were inferior in the presence of superior, or you were in front of someone who was like a king, or you would bow down. That's what they did. So she fell on her face, she bowed down, and she said, why have I found favor in your sight that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner? It's a really cool word play that's going on here in verse 10. So the verb for take notice and the noun for foreigner are both formed from the same three-letter root, NKR, nakar. So one commentator has suggested the word play here would be something like, why have you noticed the unnoticeable? Something like that. Why should you nakar me? Why should you take notice of me? Since I am a nokriya, why nakar me when I'm a nokriya? Why take notice of me when I'm really someone you shouldn't take notice of, since I'm a foreigner? So Ruth is making a play on words there, and of course communicating, why would you even pay any attention to me? I'm from Moab, and you don't really have any connection with me. At least she doesn't know that at this point. So why are you going out of your way to show mercy and compassion to me?
And what Boaz has done here would be fairly extreme if she was an Israelite. the law is like you got to let people glean, but you don't need to make sure that, you know, you don't have to say go drink out of the, go, you don't get thirsty, just go over and get a glass of water. Don't go to other fields, it's a little dangerous out there, so you know, who knows what's going to happen. I've told my guys to not mess with you, and you know, my maid, you know, stay close to the maid servants, like they're gonna watch over you. This would have all been, this is over the top if you were an Israelite. Really makes no sense in this situation. And it does seem that Boaz does have, he does seem to imply that this sort of, if you're a, you know, a young woman, that there maybe this gleaning vocation is a little hazardous.
Yeah. I would assume so. I mean, you're not protected, and you know, anything could happen to you. So yeah, he's over the top, making sure that she's taken care of. And now in verse 11, we find out a little bit more about what's drawn him to her and why he is seeing her in this way and taking care of her in this way. Verse 11, in response to her question, why have I found favor in your sight? Boaz answers her. He says, all that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me, and how you left your father and your mother in the land of your birth and came to a people that you did not previously know. May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. Or we could translate that, under whose wings you have come to seek asylum. So Boaz has heard the whole story. Hey, Bethlehem is not a big place. And I mean, I grew up in a small town. You grew up in a relatively small town. We know the way small towns work.
Yeah.
You know, somebody sneezes on one end of the town and everybody else knows about it 5 minutes later, the other end of town. So you can imagine what it was like in a village, basically, like Bethlehem. This was a small place. So by the time that Naomi showed up, I guarantee you, within an hour, everybody knew everything that had transpired. So, of course, Boaz has heard about what's happened with Naomi's return. He knows all about Ruth. He knows what she's done. He knows basically the sacrifices that Ruth has made in order to be there with her mother-in-law. All that she's done to just basically give up everything that she had previously known in order to devote the rest of her life to Naomi.
And what's interesting about Boaz too is that he says that he desires that God bless Ruth, that he repay Ruth. But then also, he's a decent theologian because he understands that if God's going to bless and repay Ruth, that he might have something to do with that.
Yeah. That's precisely that. Yeah, he's a good theologian. I love the language he uses too, because he describes her almost like an Abraham figure, right? Mm. He says, you left your father and your mother in the land of your birth. Well, that's Genesis 12 language.
Yeah.
And God says to Abraham, I want you to leave, you know, your country and your father's house and everything that you've known and go to the land that I'm going to show you. So he's described her as sort of this modern day Abraham exile who's now left her father and mother and now come to live in the land of Israel. And may the Lord reward your work, he says, and your wages be full from the Lord. In other words, may God look upon you in such a way that he sees and recognizes and responds to what you have done in such a way that you find peace and that you find security. And then he uses this image we find elsewhere in the Old Testament, beautiful image, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. So God is often pictured, and this isn't just in the Old Testament. This is actually a relatively common Near Eastern image where God is pictured as a bird with outspread wings who's sheltering her young, keeping them safe from anything that might harm them.
This is Jesus uses this image lamenting over Jerusalem.
Yeah. How many times have I longed to gather you as a chicken does her little ones, a hen gathers her little ones. So yeah, he gets it from this. And it's it's scattered throughout the Old Testament, that seeking refuge under the wings of God.
But Boaz is a little Jesus-like.
He is a little Jesus-like. Yeah,
we'll see that more and more.
Yeah, we'll get to the whole the Redeemer language is at the end of chapter 2, so we'll get to that next episode.
Yeah, well, we don't even have to wait till then. I mean, the next episode we're gonna do some. We're gonna do some bread and wine. I mean, that's a pretty Jesus move.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Well, we are out of time. Hey, things are looking up, man. I mean, you know, the first chapter is a little rough. Not as rough as Judges, but things are starting to take a turn, and things are gonna get better and better going forward. So, hopefully, you guys will stay tuned. If you want to help us out and rate and review the podcast, that does help us out. You can go to iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts to give it a rating. Say something nice about it. It helps it show up in searches a little bit more. Chad, I'll see you next week.
All right. See you then.